In a world where most people watch movies and then forget about them, these brave heroes join forces to watch them again and then talk about them. Join them in their epic journey as they go back in time, a decade and beyond, to revisit and break down films from a vast array of genres. Do these movies hold up over time? Are they classics? Find out on Retro Movie Roundtable. Starring your hosts, Brian Fry, Chad Robinson, Destin Milbarnes, Lizzie Haynes, and Russell Guest. Coming now to headphones in your ears.
Welcome all you lords, ladies, and knights of the Retro Movie Roundtable. Welcome to the show where we watch movies and then talk about them. I'm your host, Russell Guest, and joining me today is my good friend and co-host from right here in the Steel City of Pittsburgh, Mr. Chad Robinson. How you doing, sir?
It is raining, it is pouring, and I am in the mood for some invasion.
All right. From one side of town to the other, right here in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, coming to you, Mr. Benjamin Johnson, frequent guest on the show, but it has been a while. How are you doing, sir?
I'm well. I'm very good. In the rain here today, coming to you in rainy Pittsburgh.
He's that hardcore. He's standing in the rain. Podcasting literally. For you, the listeners. That's how much he wants this. So, Ben is one of our science fiction specialists here. So in honor of that, in honor of today's theme, what is your favorite spacecraft, Ben?
Favorite spacecraft would have to be the classic, Enterprise D. NCC-1701-D, beautiful 1990 streak slimline design.
Okay, so this is the one from the 90s version then.
Yeah, Star Trek Next Generation.
Yeah.
Can't beat that, I don't think.
That's a great one. Chad, what about you? What's your favorite StarCraft?
I'm going to go to the other franchise. Keep it simple with the Imperial Star Destroyer. Just, they're so massive and impressive. And seeing it in the beginning of New Hope when Devastator is chasing down 10 of 4, it's just, what a great way to kick off that franchise for new viewers, is to just see the scale of those things.
And I'm going to join Ben here, but I'm going to go older just because of the originality of it. But I'm going to go with the 60s Enterprise. USS Enterprise.
Nothing wrong with that. Yeah.
No. Set the trend for a generation.
That's right. Now, what is the last movie you saw, Ben?
The last movie I saw was a little movie called Moonfall on Prime. And it was about the moon falling into the Earth, if you couldn't imagine.
Sounds like a bad deal for Earth on this one. Today, I think we're just going to deal with flying saucers, but the whole
moon. Yeah, you got to watch the movie, though, and see how it turns out.
Was this inspired by the solar eclipse?
It was. It was.
Very nice.
I have a feeling Gru from Despicable Me was behind this. He finally stole the moon. So, Chad, what about you? What is the last movie you saw?
I have been slaving away at your request, Russell, of my top animated features, which was the hardest list I think I've ever had to fill out, and I'm still working on it. So today I covered The Iron Giant and The Prince of Egypt. I hadn't seen either of those. Those are great.
Those are great.
They're not going to dethrone anything in my top 10, but especially the music in Prince of Egypt, that is excellent.
But they make your 100?
Oh, easily, yeah.
That's great. All right. And then I am like you. I've been kicking around starting a top 100 animated movies list. And at your suggestion, I have watched Tangled. So Grant went to Disney on Ice. They had a Tangled presentation on there. And so he did not know what was going on. And I did not know either. So frying pans were out there. Songs were being sung. I didn't get it. But then we watched the movie, and now we do. So now we do get it. So
did you like it? That's one I go to bat hard for.
I enjoyed it. I enjoyed it more than paying $43 for a bubble wand. The merchandising Disney is doing at these Disney on Ice events is insane. So good on you, Disney. I mean, it's a fun time. I mean, take your kids, but it's just...
Well, we've been twice and we're still recovering. Yeah.
Well, all right. So today we are going to cover what, Chad?
We are going to cover 1956's Earth vs. Flying Saucers.
All right. This stars Hugh Marlowe and Joan Taylor. The film was released as part of a double feature. This was something that you get back in the day where two movies are purchased together. So this came together with The Werewolf from 1956. Have you seen that one, Chad, in your infinite horror depth?
I have, yes. It's not good.
So was this the better of the double feature?
Yes.
Okay, that's good. We're doing the better half of the double feature. I do not have really good metrics because before like the 70s, there's no box office data for the most part. All I can tell you is the number one box office hit that year of 1956 was The Ten Commandments. So IMDb gives this movie a 6.3. Critics Rotten Tomatoes like it better. It's 73%. Audience score, strangely, way lower at 55%. So we're a little all over the place with some of these ratings. No major awards or distinctions to go through, but Ben, had you seen this movie?
Yes.
How did you come to it?
I am on a kick of older science fiction movies, and I came across this when I was watching like Forbidden Planet and some of the other kind of like older classics. Mm-hmm. And the 50s and 60s are really an interesting time period for me as far as science fiction. And this one kind of stuck out to me.
I mean, we covered Forbidden Planet, and I definitely can see where if you like this, you will like that. So if you're enjoying today's episode, go out and check that one out. We also covered Invasion of the Body Snatchers from the 50s as well. So we're going to be right in line with these sorts of things here today. So did you like this movie upon your first watch, Ben? Like, what were you expecting? Because you've been on a kick, so I guess you were already in the right mindset. So coming to it here in 2024, is this one holding up? What is there for you?
What I found really interesting, what it followed the traditional genre of the time of this post-World War II, post-atomic bomb drop era. And I found it very interesting, kind of the outlook of the time as it pertains to looking towards the future. And it really raised this question that we're still raising today in a lot of science fiction movies about first contact. What do we do when it comes to first contact? The way that it answers the question, I think, is unique. Well, not specifically unique, because they answer it by using force.
Blast it!
Yeah. The kind of way that we answer a lot of that question in movies up until present day. But it's a really good movie because it allows you to look back and see what our ancestors kind of thought about first contact, and allows us to, you know, reflect on that.
Now, in terms of its legacy, you're a big science fiction fan in general, across all eras. Do you feel like this movie here is, you know, worthwhile? Like, if you were to make a top 100 science fiction movies, is its impact enough for you? Or are you still sticking with the more modern ones predominantly? Like, how big is this for you in terms of, like, can it hang with the more modern science fiction movies? Or is this an interesting piece of history for you?
I think it's an interesting piece of history because you really have to understand the historic aspect of the question. What do we do when we have first contact with an alien species? And then we see it from a more modern point of view, obviously, now. But historically, what would we have done in that situation is a really important question. And it might not have been the right answer, which it turns out in the movie wasn't the right answer. And not to spoil anything, but We need to, you know, grow from our mistakes and move on in the future.
Mm-hmm. Now, Chad, you are not always Mr. Science Fiction. How did this one go down for you?
This is one I saw quite a long time ago. I am a fan of Ray Harryhausen, and this is, he doesn't like this movie as much, but this is upheld. Ray Harryhausen is famous for special effects. Jason and the Argonauts is a just landmark special effect. So I went through and watched all his work. This is one, Russell, you and I talked back and forth of which version, because they colorized this later. I'm of the opinion, watch the black and white version. I think the added color doesn't do this movie any favors, but I appreciate it. There are some things that don't work for me. There are some concepts that I think are pretty novel. I like how they do time for the aliens and how that's perceived. So I think this does probably make my top 100 science fiction movies. We'll talk about the influence. This is a hugely influential movie. When you see flying saucers going forward, it's from this movie. So a lot of effects get carried over. And you see influences all the way to Mars Attacks is an homage. I did watch that after this movie. That was so fun. And obviously the big one, Independence Day. So,
and we have to realize what was going on at the time. You know, in the 50s and 60s, there were literally flying saucers buzzing the United States Capitol. And this was at the height of flying saucer fever in the United States. So this was a real reflection of the anxieties and the feelings of the American people at the time.
That's a really good point. I actually, that was smart of you to bring up the impact of the nuclear bomb going off, that something bigger than any gun or cannon that we had ever seen here. I mean, the escalation of destruction that we had witnessed as people had gone through the roof. I mean, people's minds were changing with what was possible. Mm-hmm. And
Godzilla
at the same time,
on the other side of the earth.
Yeah. Well, it's also, there's a time period where space, we haven't explored it as thoroughly at this point, to your point, Ben, and it's a point of fear. I feel like a lot of these 50s movies, you have things in space will hurt you, they're bad, and they're no, and it's dangerous. And I think that's, to some degree, like the New Frontier all over again, you know? All the animals and creatures out in the woods will kill us. Let's go kill them all first. So, I mean, I think there's a response that's human nature, certainly not just only at this point in history, but up through it, as fear of the unknown. And that's a big part of what you're seeing here. So I thought some of the acting might have been a little bit cheesy, but as you both have pointed out, there is something here. This is not worthy of a Mystery Science 3000 episode that, you know, where you just put the movie on and you're talking, act goofy the whole time. So, I mean, it has certainly aged in some ways. And I think, as you pointed out, Ben, you need to tell anybody you're handing this to either be a science fiction fan and you're interested in the history of science fiction, or that you really like, you know, invasion movies in specific or something like that, because this is, I take this as a history piece, and it's hard to only look at it as a movie because it is so very, very removed from where we are now. So,
definitely.
I mean, it's not, what's weird is we covered Metropolis, which was way, way older. And in some ways, it seems like it's in the future from now because it's so different. But this doesn't quite have that. Like, I feel like this is very, very in the past of its time. I feel like Metropolis could still be in the future in a right. way. So because this isn't a period piece or set in the future, it, in a way, it anchors itself solely to the 50s. And so therefore, I like that time period, as Chad well knows, but with science fiction, the genre had not come to full maturation yet. And so this movie, I'm starting to appreciate this and Forbidden Planet for taking steps towards it. And way, way back, Ben, you helped us cover 2001: A Space Odyssey, one of the first 10 episodes we ever covered. Mm-hmm. And as I'm covering these movies, my appreciation for 2001 has really grown because it just took huge leaps
mm-hmm.
over everything that had gone before it. And then sometimes when I, as a modern viewer, went back and watched that one, I sit there and I go like, wow, I mean, this movie is a little bit slow, but I mean, the visuals, the feel, the level of production exactly. that all went into that. And I don't think you get to 2001 without this, but without 2001, you don't get to Star Wars. You don't get to Blade Runner. You don't get to all the things that this whole thing has developed into a genre that a lot of people really love, such as yourself and myself too. So,
it's small steps. You can't get to that level without, you know, the small steps in between. Exactly. And I think another aspect of being able to reflect on something from the 50s and 60s and something like this is just a reflection on the culture. I mean, you can see like the actors and the actresses, you know, wearing suits and ties and all the females wearing, you know, dresses and stuff. And it's just a reflection of where we've come as a society. I mean, when was the last time you saw, a female wearing a dress in the future, you know, fighting aliens? You know, it's just such a reflection on society itself, a review of society, I guess you could say.
Yes. Yeah. Well, with that, let's get into this. There will be spoilers that lie ahead. So if you haven't seen Earth versus Flying Saucers, you will want to check it out. We will be back after these messages.
Welcome to the All 80s Movies Podcast.
I'm Bill.
And I'm Jason. And this is the podcast where we talk about the blockbusters, the flops, and everything in between from one of the freshest decades for movies, the 1980s. So whether you're a brain, a jock, a valley girl, or a Jedi, we've got some 80s classics for you.
Do these movies stand the test of time? Are we discovering something new? Is there an 80s movie we're finally watching for the first time?
Join us each week as we dive into the cinematic nostalgia that inspired and influenced a generation. From the hits to the cult classics, we'll discuss our earliest memories, favorite scenes, fun facts, and our not-so-favorite movie moments, too.
It's the All 80s Movies Podcast, now available on all major streaming platforms. Please subscribe and happy listening.
All right, we're back, and thank you for rejoining us. This is your final warning. There will be spoilers that lie ahead. Chad, for those who haven't seen Earth versus Flying Saucers since 1956, do you want to refresh people's memories?
The good old times, 1956. Earth finds itself under attack by mysterious flying saucers from outer space. After destroying an American space program called Project Skyhook, invaders inform Dr. Russell Marvin and his wife Carol that they intend to take over Earth and would prefer that Earth surrenders. Earth's leaders are given 2 lunar cycles to think it over. Dr. Marvin develops essentially a sonic death ray and hatches a plan for resistance. The aliens are also found to be susceptible to gunfire when outside the force field of their saucers. The humans succeed in repelling the alien invasion, but at monumental cost. You see what I did there, Russell?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Project Skyhook is reestablished, and Dr. Marvin is placed in charge to find Sarah Connors.
All right. So right off the bat, there's something really unique about this movie. You see the flying saucer very early. And this movie gets going very quickly. I was surprised at the pace of this movie.
They just jump right into it.
They did. So we meet we only meet their first 2 characters, the main characters, and pretty much they're driving down the road. And they're like, how's it going, honey? Is that a flying saucer? Yep.
Right. So, just get buzzed. Yeah.
I was expecting, the flying saucer comes down slowly and the whole city all points up to it and says, what's that thing up in the air? But no, this movie shows them that they're coming down. They're observing us. They're studying us. And they go back away. And I was one of those things where then you start to meet the characters after that. And you almost start to even, forget that, hey, flying saucers are in play, except for our scientists are obviously having trouble at their space excursion. So predictably, these things are all connected. But I thought that was I was surprised at how fast this movie moves. It feels like a modern day action movie in that regard. They give you something early to entice you, and this movie does turn into an action movie, especially for the 50s. I mean, movies at this era don't have this kind of level of action in it, both from an effects standpoint of what you actually see, but also in terms of pacing.
You're right. The characters are totally just nonplussed by the fact that they're suddenly aliens from outer space appearing.
And I really appreciate how they try to talk themselves out of it.
Yeah.
And try to rationalize the whole situation. And until they find the sound on the actual tape, they tried to like play it down and not even conceive of it until they realize they have proof.
Yeah, they're members of the scientific community. They don't want to get ostracized for coming up with the... They don't want to come into the space station and be like, you're never going to believe what I saw on the way to work today.
Right.
So that does make sense. I actually, the one that I was more surprised at was the degree of trust that Joan's father had when they told him, the general, at the barbecue. They're just like, it's like, well, we saw a flying saucer today. And there wasn't a like, come again.
Right.
Right. You need to talk to someone about this.
Or... That is supportive dad of the year.
Yeah.
I know.
Absolutely.
I know.
He's very supportive.
Joan also says, yeah, we did see the flying saucer. And he's not at all taken aback by like these. He's like, this is the second biggest surprise today I've had next to you guys who are getting married. So, right.
But then at the barbecue, they see two flying saucers as well. And then they just blow it off as flu fighters, or they call them flu fighters.
Well, I don't understand his lack of like what's going on here. But even like the policeman who like chases them excessively far, like one cop chasing them like in their speeder, like he's also not 100% aghast. And I mean, we have
when
not
he
covered
eventually close... finds the flying saucer parked on
we've,
the beach.
We've not covered Close Encounters of the Third Kind yet, but that movie contains a moment of being awestruck that what is actually right. going on here. And none of these people are remotely, you know, oh yeah, I see new things every week. Haven't seen that before.
Right. Yeah. And it's not the cult in Independence Day, or it's not the complete opposite that we get of Invasion of the Body Snatchers, where no one is listening.
Exactly. You're right. I mean, it's one of those things where it even came out like he's like, we keep losing our satellites, 1, 2, 3, 4. And he's like, what's knocking them down? He's like, well, somebody must be knocking them down. And again, I'm looking at my watch going like, we're first 15 minutes of this movie. So, and I started sitting there going like, what are they going to do? And the answer was they leaned more into actual visuals than I ever thought a movie from 1956 could ever. And that's one of those things where I was surprised that they went there. I figured with my opinion as of this era, whatever the monster is, whatever you're seeing, don't show it. The less it's on screen, the better. The more darkness you have, the more that's your friend, the more you show the people's face reacting to whatever it is, the better. And in fairness, the spacecrafts are excellent.
Yeah.
In this movie.
Were the rockets B2? German rockets,
the V2s, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
yeah V2 rockets. But to your point, Russ, like the 50s were not one for subtlety. They were not one to hide their monsters. They're like scorpions, here are giant scorpions that really aren't and clearly models, or them with the giant ants or the giant women. They are just, here you go, take it in for all it's worth. There's no subtlety here.
Yeah, and so given that that's what we're doing here, I don't know that the aliens themselves were as effective with the spacecraft. And
no.
That stuff was really good, I thought.
Yeah.
So, I mean...
The aliens were a little blocky and chunky.
Yeah.
Don't know why you model such a... So when Day of the Earth stood still, they have a robot. And, like, he moves like a robot. Or, like, we covered...
An automaton?
Forbidden Planet. You know, Robbie the robot moves like a robot. These guys have these armor, and the armor doesn't look bad like as a still frame. Like if you just take a picture of it, But yeah, Chad says he.
I will say the aliens look pretty sweet outside of their suit. We see that one that's dead before he just
looks like a traditional gray alien almost.
Yeah, and then he becomes Obi-Wan Kenobi and just becomes one with a force in front of their eyes for no good reason. Like they don't have a normal decomposition cycle.
I really just thought that they should have showed the aliens a little bit less, but they did know their limitations there. And I got to say what they did do, where you normally say, like, we're going to show all these flying saucers going around destroying buildings and stuff. I am aware I'm watching models. Like, I'm aware that that's model making. But it's also still keeping the pace, and I found this all enjoyable. I mean, as Chad already made the connection, my response was, this is Independence Day.
Mm-hmm.
Before Independence Day. Like, way before Independence Day. Like, almost 50 years before.
But the storyline is a little more sophisticated. I mean, where, you know, Independence Day was just smash them up and aliens were going to take over. I mean, this was the aliens' whole concept was they're going to try to infiltrate and subdue humans and try to avoid an invasion. You know, it was there. They had a plan. And this whole concept is actually played on later in other, there's a series called Colony, where this whole concept is played upon, where the aliens take over and they put people in place to run the new government. And it just, it's a really cool series that only lasted like one season. But this whole idea of the government the aliens infiltrating the government and it leads to a whole bunch of conspiracy theories now that exist and everything as well. But that's all the precursor, you know, from that stems from Earth versus the flying saucer.
I did really appreciate that conversation with the aliens where they're essentially telling the Marvins, look, it is really resource intensive and time consuming to take over a planet.
Mm-hmm.
That's not plan A for us. Can you please just surrender and save us some time? So it was nice to get alien diplomacy.
This really leads to the big question about first contact and how we perceive ourselves in the galaxy. And if you think of the galaxy as a big risk board, and first contact, we're going to be like a little colony somewhere. And the aliens are going to come to us and say, listen, you know, it was just like us going in the South Pacific during World War II. And these little, you know, colonies in the South Pacific, the aliens are not going to really care about our problems or what we think or give to craps about us, really. They're going to want to worry about their wars, their people, their politics. And, you know, if they want to build a highway through our solar system and they need to demolish our planet, like in Hitchhiker's Guide, they're going to do it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
They're going to displace us. Or let's hope, the only hope that we have is that they're friendly and benevolent.
E.T. would be a good alternative, but we do not have E.T. here. So
yeah,
want Reese's Pieces.
If you look at it, it doesn't bode well for us when we do make first contact, and it's not going to be the traditional. Just the aliens come in and destroy us. The only valuable resource here on Earth is the humans.
I thought it was unique, like you said, though. There's a warning. We'd like for you to surrender. That is kind of unique for these invasion kind of movies that I'm aware of.
Yeah.
There's a warning. So like Day of the Earth Stood Still comes about 5 years, 5 years before this one. And they come to Earth to warn us. Like that's why they've come here. And, you know, they expect something from us and it does turn into a governmental discussion, all that stuff. You have this in this movie, but it's way, way faster. It's not the main part of this movie. That's maybe the side dish of what's going on here. But I thought it was interesting. I found myself going like, these guys are so invasive. Why not just get down to business and start taking over. I thought that was an interesting thing. It gave another moment there, as you mentioned, Ben, to see people's view towards science in the 50s. There's a time period here where we're very optimistic. We've just won the war, and the United States has, you know, got this very optimistic time. And so the answer to this fear of the unknown is man's ability to think. Science will be our friend. Technology is the answer. These are solutions. And there's a time to embrace new ideas and new things. So,
and the U.S. military can overcome any obstacle.
Right. Now, what I'm describing, in many ways for technology or adoption of new things, it's great. I think it's one of the reasons why, you know, architecture is fantastic at this time. It makes leaps and bounds at this point. But here we can see that. So in one hand, you're looking backwards towards just like something new, shoot it, you know. But on the other hand, there's also this, I think one of the coolest things of the mid-century post-war era is that optimism and that belief and that desire to try something else. So in the end, they designed a ray gun, which I don't know how the aliens let that slide through their fingers. And like, I mean, how do they, where's the, we'll give you 24 hours to think about it.
Well, it was two lunar cycles. So that's what, 40, 80 days. It's about 40 days. So
we don't need that long to talk.
It's still, you know, zero to death ray in, we'll say, 40 days. That's quite the scientific.
Good. That's pretty good.
Yeah. Yeah, especially for the 50s. Like,
I still never really got a grasp of what the death rate did, other than like maybe intoxified the aliens. Like, it disrupted the ship and made it wobble and it crashed the ship. But
had very poor aim. Like, constantly just shooting them down right by all the monuments and about the fifth or sixth.
Apparently, the monuments attract aliens.
I mean, they're visiting too. So
I
believe the term you're looking for, Ben, is the gun gives them the shimmy shimmy shakes.
That must be it.
I guessed it was some form of like early EMP, but it's a long range EMP.
I think I know what you mean though, Ben. Like, in a movie that shows you so much, why do we not get to see the aliens like frothing at the mouths, being like, I can't take
this.
Like
in War of the Worlds or something. Yeah, but it just did, all we know is it did something to the aliens' gravity drive and it crashed the ships. But
the device itself, in the end. The device itself, I felt like, he worked on it for a long time, so obviously it's not created for aesthetics or whatever, but I felt like these cannons that we're using don't look
like you and
science fiction space weapons together. Exactly. They looked a little bit
homemade.
Sorry. They did. And in fairness, like you said, like they were made in 40 days. We don't have time to get it. I didn't feel like we were looking at the next generation of weaponry for something.
Yes.
Can you put some spikes on it for Russell's sake, just so it's all future-y?
I don't know. Glue some springs on the side of this thing, make it look lighter weight or something like
your that. Your death ray has to look a whole lot cooler than a fourth grader's paper mache volcano.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I really expected, I paused, there's it's not there, but I expected to see like a toilet paper dowel kind of taped on there.
Well, I mean, America, our stuff, look at the B-2 bombers. It is very practical, but it is also very cool.
So yes.
If we're going to blow your stuff up, it's going to look cool while we're doing it.
Exactly.
I agree. Again, we just got talking. I mean, 50s, this is a stylish time. People dressed well. People made nice looking things. They drove nice looking cars. They built nice buildings. Can't our guns look nice?
Right.
I mean, as you're off to your grave, at least as you're bleeding out, you can sit there and go like, that's a nice looking gun.
I was shot by a handsome man.
That's a new model.
This sounds like an Archer episode. Just Sterling Archer saying, I'm not firing that. That doesn't look cool enough. Can you build something cooler? Like Death Ray, and Yeah.
The scientist just looks at him and goes like, you do know the whole planet's at risk, right? And this works. Like, yeah. I mean, it's only day 39, though, so you got to make it look good. So.
Right. They had to mass produce them and everything. So, yeah.
It gets a bunch of red marks and sent back. Yeah. Can you fix this?
So in terms of the acting, this is not a who's who of the acting world.
No.
This is not a high budget movie. As I discussed earlier, it's a double feature, and I think it has overachieved in many ways for what it was expected to be, or at least what the production studios were expecting from it. So my question is, acting-wise, Ben, how's that? It is a little bit cardboard, if you will. Is that impacting you here, or have you come to say, like, this is what I want from my 50s science fiction movies? I want a little bit of cheese. I want a little bit of cardboard, and I want a little bit of cheese.
You know, it's hard to separate modern acting from, like, once you have good, like, modern acting, and then to see, like, a traditional 50s actor and actress, because it is so stereotypical. Like, you have the stereotypical lead male role, straight white, the traditional straight white female role. That's, I mean, look at the two main actor and actresses in this. They were just married, they're madly in love. Like, was all that even necessary? But that same scenario is replicated over and over again in every 50s movie. Like, the two main characters are in love, and it's always an older man to a younger woman. So it's, for me, the acting was fine. It's what you come to expect. So it's kind of like going back to your favorite old blanket. Just, you know, you watch it for comfort. You don't really expect, an Emmy-winning performance.
In some ways, it's an action movie as much as it's a science fiction movie. And if you were to make an action movie today, you don't go out of your way to get amazing actors most of the time.
Mm-hmm. Right. Jason Statham is who he is.
Correct. Correct.
I like the two leads. To your point, yeah, it falls off a cliff very, very shortly after the two leads, but I thought they were pretty competent. Joan Taylor does get more work after this, so she works with our director again on the, I think it was like 20,000 Fathoms. I thought they did a pretty good job for what a 50s movie is. There's classic 50s moment where there's just absolute, to paraphrase, Blazing Saddles. That's some good old fashioned 50s gibberish where they just spit out something with large words. Like, none of those words mean what you think they mean, but you're trying to make, just escort us through the science into the next plot point. So I always like that dude that shows up. In this case, it was mostly our main character, but I appreciated that the fact Dr. Carol or Dr. Marvin and his wife, Carol Marvin, she was actually competent. Like, you don't see that a lot in the 50s. She had an integral part. She's quoting Shakespeare, so she's very intelligent. She helps decipher the alien language. I'm like, this is all unusual, where usually you'd be abducted by the alien and put in a skimpy outfit that the aliens just have convenient for you.
You're right. That's a good point. I mean, you still have the 1950s. She's very subservient at home.
Yes.
Like, in that scene, like, I mean, she's ready to very much take care of her husband. But in other ways, I will 100% echo what you're saying, Chad. I think that in some ways, you don't get that a lot in the 50s.
No.
You know, she's in the building, and she's not, like, taking – she's not the secretary. I mean, to actually have a woman with that clearance to be there, even if by – Dr. Marvin saying, like, yeah, I want her here. That's progressive in many ways too. So I think you got a good point there. And I think we made it this far in the show. Every time we say Dr. Marvin, I cannot help but think about the What About Bob Dr. Marvin. Yes. So I have been avoiding it very hard because my head goes to What About Bob every time someone says Dr. Marvin.
So. Delicious. Is it hand shucked?
No, I don't get angry, Bob. We have to talk about Ray Harryhausen. His name is in here as much as anybody's, and the effects that he created, you know, it says in his biography that this is his least favorite of his films. I can't believe that because I don't necessarily recognize a ton of his work, but he seems to be very influential. And Chad, you said you did a deep dive on him, which is very cool. Can you tell us a little bit more about Ray Harryhausen?
Yeah, I think his most famous work are The Skeletons Coming Up and Jason and the Argonauts. I think this one, he gets annoyed by the fact this is his last stop motion effort. And so his famous Skeletons Rising Up was stop motion as well. And it seems like he's remembering how much work it was to have all these monument effects. And he's just saying, this was more work than it was worth to me. It just seems to be annoying to him. He's having to hand paint out all the wires for the flying saucers because they didn't have CGI. There's nothing like that. They're literally on strings that he's then having to go in and hand paint them out against a background of clouds. So he is just a revolutionary and so influential in the 50s and throughout. I mean, we get Mars Attacks as an homage to him. Director was a huge Ray Harryhausen fan. It wasn't the director of this movie, which was Fred Sears. They were a fan of Ray's.
Which is Tim Burton, the director of Mars Attacks, which is not a total shock, because if you like stop motion animation, Tim Burton was saying as a child, he was experimenting with, you know, stop motion animation. And obviously, if this is the industry standard of the time, you don't get Nightmare Before Christmas. You don't get, you know, Corpse Bride. You don't get these motion, stop motion masterpieces that are pretty much the pinnacle of it. It's fun having covered that movie and seeing all the work that went into those characters. The amount of time that goes into each second of that movie is just out of this world, really. And to see where it comes from here. Again, we keep saying it, this movie walks so other movies can run, but it is interesting. I would be curious to see a few more of his movies.
How did you miss Clash of the Titans? We had to watch that high school, I think.
I was given Remember the Titans in my class.
Also excellent. Very not stop motion.
Not stop motion at all. So in terms of the science fiction movie that was suggested by a 1953 nonfiction book, Flying Saucers from Outer Space. So there is, I guess, some source material here by U.S. Marine Corps Major Donald Keough, who believed a certain aerial phenomena were interplanetary in origin. And so, Ben, you are more in tune with the history of the flying saucer, you know, craze. And how this movie... So you said this is kind of in the peak of it. When did that all get going?
So it started right around the Roswell crash in 1946, I believe. Mm-hmm. And it reached its peak around the 50s, around the early 50s, around 55, I believe. But there was just a wave of sightings around the U.S., around military installations. And there was a famous sighting around the White House. There were actual UFOs sighted around the Congress building and around the White House in Washington. At the time, we've kind of lost perspective due to time, but it was very common, just everyday occurrences. People would see UFOs at the time. And this was the same time that Eisenhower was president. And this is the time that most UFO conspiracy theorists believe that Eisenhower met with aliens and had the first what they call pact or truce with aliens and set up this whatever we have today, the conspiracy that exists today with aliens.
I think another part of the writing crew here, Bernard Gordon, another thing that's going on at this time is McCarthyism. So Bernard Gordon, one of the screenwriters, was originally credited as Raymond T. Marcus because of the Hollywood blacklist, where they were deemed to be socialist and subversive. So Hollywood has a ton of these. This isn't the first time we've seen this in the show, but that fear from who's who here is also here in 1956. Invasion of the Body Snatchers was 56, the same year that we covered this one. So we're right there too with that.
Didn't that feel like a huge miss when their satellite started going missing though? Like my mind instantly went to, we're going to blame Russia, right?
Right.
It doesn't even get brought up. They're just like, oh, well, I wonder where it went.
I was very surprised at that. So,
and to keep launching too, they're like, we're going to just keep launching more.
Again, that just goes with what you were talking about, Chad. People are very quick to accept aliens into their lives here and then secondarily to blow them up. But I was just really, I did the same thing that you did, Chad. I was like, he's like, you mean somebody took them out of the sky? What do you mean? You think the Russians are doing it? Nope, aliens. Oh, yeah, yep, aliens. Yep.
Right.
It's got to be. So,
yeah, there's not even really any question. They're just, where did it go? All right, to Ben's point, let's launch another, see what happens. Oh, that one's gone too. Well, third time's the charm.
Ninth one? Just keep sending these $1 million.
Yeah, everyone is really just nonchalant about this entire ordeal.
I was going to, even Dr. Marvin's the only one who seems remotely like, I don't want to lose my satellites. I worked for this thing.
Yeah, we lost our entire Skyhook lab. This is a huge deal. How will we ever build the T-1000?
Well, it's Skyhook, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. I can't not think of Kareem Abdul-Jabbar's Skyhook hookshot. So, I mean, I can't get Kareem Abdul-Jabbar out of my head with this one, who's very tall, and perhaps he's not of this planet because of his unusual height there. So,
works for me, Russell.
Yeah.
And he's great in other movies. He's not around for acting in 1956, no. But I would be down with him being the general. Like, you just show up and it's some 7-foot athlete.
He's great in Airplane for sure. So,
absolutely.
We do have a lot of identifiable moments here. This is a very Washington-heavy movie. We've got the White House, we've got the nation's Capitol building, Washington Monument, Union Station, and we're crashing into all of them. It's like the who's who of what can we crash into here. So long before we saw the World Trade Centers hitting in wreckage, and long before Independence Day blew up the nation's Capitol with a big laser beam again, another one of those Independence Days, borrowing heavily from this one. This one has particularly likelihood to land on important buildings, not houses, or in the middle of water, or an open grassy field. In fact, resoundingly over and over again, crashing into something identifiable.
Which is odd, because they're always out in Nebraska, right? Like, they're doing those crop circles. There's no crop circles in Washington, D.C.
No.
Yeah. Yeah, nor Iowa. Yeah, you're right. Good point. I think that's one of those things where they were, again, Ben was talking about, like, they wanted to strike fear. If it could hit here, I think they were going for maximum chill factor by doing that.
There's not too much in New Mexico to crash into.
Yeah, if it just falls down and falls on a cow field.
Yeah, does it still make noise?
Yeah, and the cows are still just chewing grass, looking at it, going like,
Right.
That's odd.
They would have the same level of enthusiasm as the rest of the crowd. So
I did think it was interesting. Other parts of the world are shown. I think it would have been cool to see more global invasion around the world, like to see a Paris invasion. some Eiffel Towers getting hit too, since we like to fall on highly identifiable landmarks. We could fall on Big Ben, London Bridge, etc.
Yeah, the Great Wall getting blown up, something that like would be that.
Cool. Yeah, yeah. So I know this is a very U.S.-centric time, pro-U.S. sort of thing, but this is a global threat, and so we don't necessarily get that.
Right. Yeah. It's get the world leaders together. It's like, nah, USA, USA.
Yeah, who's in charge of your planet? Somebody in the U.S.
Right.
Do we need to talk to anybody else? Nah.
Nah, not really.
Not really. No.
It's the Dennis Leary. You know why? Because we got the bombs.
we'll speak for everybody.
I do like that we completely managed to tick off Britain by making this movie, though. Just by showing their destroyer being blown up. Like, that's actual footage of the HMS Barnum being blown up in 1941. And we did not give them a heads up whatsoever. And so Britain kind of lost their cool over that.
Oh, did not know that.
Before combating the aliens, I have thought, like, shouldn't they have, like, showed their poker hand, like, of, like, you know, it's like, I don't know, Russia's the center of everything that's important. I mean, that would be very, very bad if you were to attack Russia.
It would suck if you would take out Russia.
I mean,
yeah,
I really think everybody would absolutely take you seriously, but you can't topple Russia. You couldn't do it.
Napoleon couldn't do it. He's one of our greatest warriors.
You might be able to invade the U.S., and I'll give you that. 100%. But there's not a chance you're going to get Russia. Germany couldn't do it. And they're really smart. I don't know that you're as smart as the Germans.
There you go. Challenge the aliens.
Yeah. Then let them destroy Russia and then be like, okay, now this is a problem.
Have them meet with the Russian emissaries and then release doves to see if they go nuts.
We were going to fight whoever the survivor of this is, but I just wanted to see it with popcorn in my hands, you know?
You've just recreated Alien versus Predator tagline, whoever wins, we lose.
Nice.
Some other things that we see get in the special effects department. This movie goes big on stock footage. As you mentioned, there's actual satellite launches, stock footage of Viking rockets. There's the laser shots of the rockets crashing and takeoffs that are really V2 missiles. And one of the scenes had a flying saucer attacking jets that's actually based on footage of an air crash. There's a scene of a destroyer being blown up that's actually stock footage of a sinking HMS Barnum, which occurred in 41. So I know they can't afford to do everything with miniatures, and I know that Harryhausen has his limits with what he can do, but how do you feel about going heavy on this stock footage, Ben? Or is it just, this is what you did at the time?
I didn't have a problem with the stock footage. I thought it hit the, it hit the mark, got across the point. And as long as you know what you're looking at, you know that it's a stock footage, I think it's fine. I didn't have a problem with it.
Yeah.
Chad, I thought it was interesting.
I do appreciate that they changed the rockets. So the early shots, the launches are of Viking Vanguards, but they don't have any shots of Viking Vanguards failing. They never failed. So they have to use the V2s for the explosions. So we've got the stock footage of a different rocket that's blowing up there. And then the Vanguard later on actually does blow up on a launch pad, just to like in this movie, but they didn't have any stock footage of it. It's something, there's like a plane flyover stock footage that you see in almost every 50s movie where they call out the military. There's a bunch of planes. You'll see the B-29 flying fortresses going overhead. To me, that's nostalgia bait. Like, I enjoy that. It's just something that I look for and say, it's like a Wilhelm scream if you just go, there it is. And it's not great, but it's comforting.
Where does the Wilhelm scream originate from? This is something that you see brought up of like, has a Wilhelm scream. And
been going on for like 70 years, hasn't it?
That's why I ask. I actually don't know the answer to that.
And it's present in the 70s, I know that. Through the magic of editing, I actually found the answer to what we were talking about. So the Wilhelm Scream has been around since 1951 with the film Distant Drums. And it's actually named for Private Wilhelm in The Charge at Feather River, which is a 1953 Western. But it gets popularized by Star Wars. That's where I was thinking of it most, is it's very present in all the Star Wars films.
Okay, so that's where the Wilhelm, in the Wilhelm, comes from.
Yes. That's right. The 1953 stock effect.
We have not seen that movie, so we'll have to cover that someday so we can do the original Wilhelm Scream then.
I'm concerned about that era and Western films. Mm.
And the quest is to cover every movie. It's required.
Where we just walk away halfway through and just say, this was wildly racist.
Before we give up and after we cover every movie, we want to have to figure out something else retro to talk about. I don't know what it'll be.
So, there you go.
Retro shoe roundtable.
Brian, I need some people to help you with that one.
There you go. Brian wants it to be retro book roundtable. So.
Oh.
So three flying saucer models were made. One made from wood that were actually made by Raoul Housen's father. The flying saucers were suspended by piano wires, as you mentioned, Chad, practically invisible against the background of clouds. And for these, Housen had to paint the wires out every single frame by frame. And the death ray that were used by the saucers was an in-camera effect of using Roman candles. So yep. I have to say, they do a lot. I keep forgetting at times when I watch this, and I sometimes can criticize moments that can get a little bit rough. And then I remember, no money. So that's the other thing that is surprising. It does seem ambitious for a film that has no money. In fact, when you make a movie that has no money, you almost start from the standpoint of another 50s movie we covered, 12 Angry Men. How much can we do in one little room with the fewest number of characters possible? Like, what requires a few number of scene changes? The more interior shots, the better. And this movie just threw all of that out. Just said, I don't care. We're just going to go for it. And if they didn't have that enterprising spirit, then we would never get out of one room movies.
There seems to be a lot of reusing because you've mentioned The Day the Earth Stood Still, and that shows up in this movie. And then things from this movie show up in other movies. We have a brief shot of the Washington Monument is used in The Giant Claw. The death ray is used again in 20 Million Miles to the Earth. Mm-hmm. So it's getting
Robbie the robot is in like every other science fiction movie.
Yeah,
he does pop up a lot.
It's because it's back in the day, like you said, it was expensive to build something as complicated as Robbie the robot. So in order to share the cost, the studio would own it, and then the studio would just simply place it in more of its productions.
I think Robbie should still pop up in things. I mean, Disney makes movies where the mouse ears and symbol will pop up in the background and things. So mm-hmm. I propose we bring Robbie back mid...
Like in a Star Trek episode?
It would not have made this last Terminator movie that came out any worse to have had Robbie Robot.
No. In
it. So it wasn't that great of a movie, though. I would rather see Arnold fight Robbie the Robot. That would
wait, be Arnold was in the last... this last
Dark Fate, yeah.
Oh, no.
Terminator,
no.
Dark Fate. It's not James Cameron.
Yeah,
that's all I'll say.
It's an easy jump from Skyhook to Skynet. So
there you go. All right. Are there any other special effects moments that you really caught your eye, Ben, that you wanted to draw out that made you go like, I'm really enjoying this, like the visuals of what this looks like?
I thought the way that the spaceship landed was weird, how it landed, it could land on the ground, but then it would have to lift up for that cylinder to come down.
Yeah.
And so I guess the dynamic, they still needed to work out kind of like the dynamics of how it landed.
You'd like little feet.
Like yeah. Like Mars Attacks. Make right. it cute.
Mm-hmm.
Like little yeah. feet or something.
Like, I did not mind the wavy lines, actually, that come out below the flying saucer, which is, I think, necessary for them, like the heat wave looking thing.
Oh,
which,
the shield?
Yeah, they definitely have these transitions that are going to be very hard to handle And I have to admit, that was a acceptable way to me, given the limitations that they have to deal with that.
There were some issues, but I think that the models worked very well.
And I'll tell you, one set design piece I really liked was inside the ship. Mm-hmm. That's just like, that's a set, but I mean, it's really cool.
The giant viewport. Yeah.
I mean, when you go in an alien ship, I think that's one of those moments of, you know, it has to deliver, whether it be, you know, Flight of the Navigator and be fun and funky, or whether it be, you know, scary, like the X-Files, or in this case, it was more empty and more minimal than I ever expected. I think it's cool that you have these voices and you don't know where they're coming from. I think all of that's really good. And I think that gets reused in other things too.
I wish there would have been like a, maybe this comes up later, but like an alien brain or something.
I thought that's what that disco ball type thing. At the
I thought that was just like a translator.
Maybe, nope.
They were absorbing the thoughts. So like everything the general knew had been absorbed.
Yeah, through those bad X-ray effects where we get the brain flashing.
I did want the cop guy to be I wanted his brain to get absorbed and then have the aliens be like, this guy doesn't know nearly as much.
He doesn't know.
This isn't useful. All I know is maple donuts are the best. And
right.
Can we just give that back to him? You can have your brain back, sir. You need it.
For a species that was very concerned about how much time and energy it was going to take over a planet, the people they're deleting with their advanced weaponry are like old men walking with canes. I didn't understand their target priority. Like, they do take out a couple army guys laying down for no good reason other than that's a classic pose. There's like a dude in the park with a cane and we just shoot him. Why?
They don't know.
Oh, they know.
The cane could be a weapon.
You just said they absorbed all.
Oh, that's a good point. They do know.
We absorbed military knowledge. Old man with cane is not.
They got a high-ranking smart guy in there.
Yeah. So. Although that dude was immensely sweaty. I don't understand what was going on. I guess that was just a...
If you went in an alien ship, you'd be sweating too.
The Marvins held up remarkably well. They were pristine. That dude was like in a sauna.
You're right. Hair gel at that time was like, you know, he didn't... you're right. Everybody was prim and proper. Again, it's the 50s. Everybody had to look good.
Yeah.
I'm going on an alien ship. I need to look my best.
Dapper Dan, man.
Hold on before I step on the ship. Let me get my hair adjusted. Very nice. Yeah,
he did. His hair was magnificent.
Now, musically, what do you feel about the music that we have here, Ben?
I was, you know, moved along by it. I didn't think it was going to win any major awards.
Well, they went big. But, I mean, the movie's big in every way. Sometimes older movies... I think you have this a little more in the 40s. They have these big swells of something that's happening and nothing's actually going on. This movie actually has something big going on.
He's calling back to Treasures of Sierra Madre, where there was just this very ominous score and they had opened a sluice gate. There's just water flowing down a trough.
I know. I thought an avalanche was about to happen or like a landslide. It's like, uh-oh, somebody's going to die. The landslide's coming and no, it's just water. We have water running through a wood trough.
Missed opportunity.
That was somebody that wrote a score, and he's just like, "I'm gonna use it.
Use it, damn it!"
Right? You know what? I don't know how early we get this like loud brass and ominous strings for alien invasions, but again, this is cozy comfort for me. This is what I expect from alien invasion type 50s movies, especially ones with heavy military action. So standard fare, but it makes me happy.
Yeah.
Chad is happy on this episode. I have to say, if you hand him Blade Runner, he's gonna cross his arms and glare at you and say, I don't want your dystopian, pessimistic future. Give me military missiles and guns and...
Well, in the end, it all turned out for the best, so...
Yeah. Is it the fact that everybody is afraid of these aliens in a horror adjacent kind of thing that's working for you, Chad?
It is sort of horror adjacent. I'm very surprised because you said it is it's a double feature with a horror movie that this one doesn't fall into that category. Things like Them and Invasion of the Body Snatchers fall purely into horror. But I think it's a mixture of things because we talk about Forbidden Planet. I didn't have a good time on Forbidden Planet. And I think part of
I remember you didn't. That's why I'm surprised. Like you're doing really well here. Like you're not getting the, this is genuine enthusiasm. Right. He's not faking it, ladies and gentlemen.
Yeah. I think Forbidden Planet aggravated me because the treatment of women is far worse in Forbidden Planet, where he's just like, here's my daughter, sleep with her. It's great. And I'm like, what? Well, you just made contact. You don't even know how their genitalia works. What is happening here? Whereas as far as the 50s go, this is as good as we're going to get as far as treatment of women. I think it was nice having Carol Marvin be a good part of it. There are so many plot holes, but to your point, I think I could watch a Riff Trax episode of this and be just as happy. We are slowly approaching getting Russell to do Santa Claus Conquers the Martians, and I want that so bad. That is good in both formats. So,
did you watch the black and white?
Ben, I did.
Or did you watch? Sorry, Ben, did you do black and white or the colorized version?
The color version.
Both are free out there if you're looking for them. So the audience can. Chad feels like the color takes away from some of it. Do you feel like you wanted it in black and white?
Now that he mentions it, I would probably, if I were to do it again, I would probably do the black and white. The color was a little distracting.
Was, okay.
Yeah.
The director said that, you know, if you could have, I would have done color. It just wasn't available to us initially at the time, so I would have gone for it. So Fred Sears said that. So Chad, you think it was a benefit to go black and white. Do you want to explain why you feel like what was so distracting?
It just helps mask some of the more obvious modeling issues and the effects. So the people, it looks fine in whatever pseudo technicolor this is. It's certainly no Wizard of Oz. You don't get that awe-inspiring moment. So when you can go black and white, you can hide a lot more things than you can in color. And yeah. I think this movie stands out as a special effects accomplishment when you're hiding it in black and white.
Well, what do you say we hand out some superlatives, you guys?
Love to.
All right, Ben, who is the MVP of Earth versus Flying Saucers?
If I had to give an MVP, which I do, I would say the general, Morris Akram. He was the first one to get his brain sucked.
That's true. Yeah. He was the sweaty dude.
Yeah. Again, a useful brain to actually get a hold of.
Right? Yeah. He knew the whole contingency of the military.
Right. I know.
That's how he knew.
Of all Earthlings, I kept thinking, is like, think how many people you would just get off the street and be like, I don't need to know this.
Right. You're actually worse off for having sucked up the brain of whoever's on the street. It's like, nope, didn't need to know that. For me, it's Ray Harryhausen. I've covered him. I've gushed about him. He's just a legend in the industry. He's the reason to see this movie. His special effects are why this film is still relevant, why it's used and influential.
I'm with you, Chad. I was surprised to see... Rarely, not always, but sometimes, like when we covered Aliens or Terminator, the special effects guys are big forces in this. And this time, he's as big as the director, maybe bigger. So half the information, which there's not a lot of information about this movie out there compared to some of the movies we cover, but I mean, half of it's about Ray Harryhausen, and he has quite a fan following. So I was excited to get more acquainted with him here. So MVP for him. Chad, who's your best supporting?
I went with Joan Taylor as well. I think she did a great job. She stands out in the reviews as well. People are commenting on her performance. I think she came off as smart and capable in an era where women aren't always given that chance. So kudos to her, and she gets more work because of it.
I said Donald Curtis as Major Hughlin, but you guys both have a good point with Joan Taylor. So yeah, I think Joan Taylor is probably the choice, but to be different, I'm going to go with Donald Curtis.
So, okay.
Do it.
Hidden Jim, Ben.
I would say I like the element or the cast members of the... I'll give it up to the military.
Just the military. Giving it up to the military.
The military people.
That makes sense. The hardworking men
and women in the military. Cast of the military.
That's great. All right. Chad, how about you? Who's your hidden gem?
I mentioned her earlier, but I was a big fan of I Dream of Jeannie growing up. And Barbara Eden is one of the passengers in the opening airliner shot. So she's over on the left-hand side. So getting to see Jeannie, she doesn't have any speaking roles, but hidden gem there.
All right. That is mine as well. And even before I read that fact, I happened to notice in the play, I was like, they seem to get somebody who's, I don't know. She's pretty striking for just an extra on a plane. And sure enough, that was Barbara Eden. I didn't recognize her not being a genie coming out of a lamp, but that was her.
Right.
Do you think she carries that lamp with her so people know?
I don't know, but she could have fixed a lot of things if she had her genie powers in this.
Yeah.
I mean, she would have just crossed her arms and blinked her eyes, and then we're having a fun time. The aliens are gone. Probably some hijinks will ensue, as usually happens. So, I mean, yeah. All right. Recast. If you had to recast somebody and put somebody else in their place, Ben, who are you recasting?
The main actor, Hugh Marlowe. I would have gone with just a better, more attractive, you know, better actor. But I realized, you know, they couldn't afford it.
If you made this today, who would you toss in there maybe in his place? Unless there's a classic science fiction actor that you would want to throw in there. But I mean,
oh, I don't know.
Well, this is like an Idris Elba role today, right?
Yeah.
He's a more academic guy. You don't need him to be like, you don't need him to fist fight the aliens. I mean,
yeah, but you still want to have some sort of sex appeal, right?
This is a Benedict Cumberbatch kind of thing today, right? Like you need somebody brainy.
I feel like Idris comes off as very smart.
I was thinking like maybe, yeah, you could do a Cumberbatch.
Yeah.
Sure.
Ilba spends too much time in the weight room. This guy spent all of his time doing science.
Yeah. So
the only exercise that this guy is going to get is from lifting his science books and his giant computer parts that would have been massively sized. So, Chad, recast.
I am sadly going after Ben's MVP of Morris Ankrum. I didn't particularly like the general here. I want Vincent Price. So give me Vincent Price and give me a less sweaty version.
Okay, less sweat for Chad. All right, I'm going to go after Hugh Marlowe right at the top as well. And I'm going to go with, for Dr. Marvin, I'm going with Kevin McCarthy, who you would know from Invasion of the Body Snatchers. So
yes.
I think he's a better lead man. But I think they had more money on that one. So again, I'm being a little unfair.
He's also double booked. Yeah.
He can't be in two movies at once necessarily. But you know what? In my world, they can be. So 56 is just going to be a big, busy year for Kevin McCarthy for me. Best shot, Ben.
Probably one of the flying saucers crashed into particularly the Capitol building, because like when the model broke away, I remember you could see like the truss work in one of the arches. And I thought that was like real stunning attention to detail.
That was so cool, yeah.
Chad, best shot.
I'm actually going to use a scene from another movie. So when the Marvins get taken into that saucer, the view of Earth with that hazy moon, that's actually the opening shot of The Day the Earth Stood Still. It's a great shot then. It's a great shot here. So kudos for reusing assets.
You can reuse anything from that movie. That's a great one too. Well, my best shot's going to be the inside the alien flying saucer. I mentioned it has to do with the set design, but there's also the general is seen from below looking up into the dark. That's a great shot for me. Great set design. Ben, best scene.
best scene for me was the scene at the command center, I guess, when the military was working to first engage the flying saucers. I thought it was interesting to see everybody, or at the command center when they were launching the first missiles. Mm-hmm. Or missile number 10, I guess it was. And the general was just trying to get through to persuade them not to launch the missile, but they were getting the news that it was being destroyed or whatever. I thought it was just interesting to see the technology of the time and to see what it they thought it took to put a missile in a satellite into space.
All right, Chad, best scene for you.
I really like the scene inside the saucer where the aliens are explaining to the Marvins how time is perceived to them. Like, Dr. Marvin can't detect a heartbeat. He can't hear his watch tick. And so they talk about, we operate between the ticks of a watch. I think that's a really fascinating concept.
Mm. My best scene was where the four people went into the flying saucer. We had Dr. Marvin and we had Dr. Marvin Carroll going into the flying saucer. We had the guy who was shadowing Dr. Marvin. That was a lot of fun. I really enjoyed how playful that was, and, you know, him having to go with them and not just going into this, you know, following his job that much that he's like, most people at that point were like, I'm out. You can get into the ship if you want to, but he's following orders. So,
right.
He's in it to win it.
To a lower degree, as I mentioned, the policeman who's chasing them going into like guy with no obligation, just going into is like, okay, we're going into the spaceship now. Okay. So, best wardrobe or makeup moment?
My favorite obviously is the alien.
Oh, the one outside of the suit?
Yeah, when they take the suit head off.
Yeah, that's mine as well. That shriveled up being.
Yeah.
That's what I want from the get-go, or do the Mars.
Yeah. I thought that there was going to be more of that, like, at a climax inside the alien ship, you know, other than the rotating light.
Yeah, totally. Yeah,
and then those two, just random two behind the screens that had their helmets on. I just wish they would have taken the helmets off for those two.
Exactly, yeah, me too.
Chad, how about you?
Mine was the same thing for the wardrobe. I'm right there with Ben. I love the shriveled up alien. I'm with Ben as well. Take off the helmets when you're in the ship.
Yeah.
You're not in atmosphere anymore. Just show us your shriveled ugliness.
Mm-hmm. My best wardrobe or makeup moment is going to be, I like the leather jacket Dr. Marvin has at the end of the movie. It's good.
That is great stuff.
Classic 50s.
Yeah. Not the armor. I have to say, the armor on the aliens is probably not exactly.
It's unwieldy. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's an extension of their body.
But you'd think they could at least put on their invading pants, like
instead of their Pampers.
Right.
Exactly. I figured if you move that poorly, you either have to be a very peaceful alien, or you have to have vehicles that move you well. Like in the Fifth Element, they don't get around well, but that's okay. They're peaceful aliens in like this armor. Like they're not here to invade, and you're not going to invade anybody waddling around like a penguin. So, Ben, yes, change sir. One thing.
If I could change one thing about the movie, I would give them a bigger budget for special effects.
Ooh, I like bigger
budget. More money is always good.
Yeah. Yeah. I love to see what Ray does with a much bigger budget.
Yeah.
And other people to do work with him and stuff. You're right. Chad, change one thing.
I think the reason we remember this movie is the crashing into monuments, but I also think they went to that well one too many times. So the climax is essentially shoot spaceship, crash into monument, rinse, repeat like 6 or 7 times. Just one or two, and then maybe switch to rural Nebraska or something where they're crashing in cornfields, or show Area 51 and there's another crash. That's a neat thing they could do, but we don't need the same thing every time.
Mm-hmm. And I want some time in the plot. This is a direction thing. I just want a little bit of time in the front to have, did these guys come in peace? Like, just that's some suspense.
They came and gave us the option to be in peace.
Yeah, surrender or destroy.
Yeah.
Maybe we don't have to talk to them so much. Maybe the flying saucers hover over the planet for a day or something.
And they never told us what occupation was going to be. Like, right. Slavery or like,
just yeah, that's
go
true.
About they your didn't... everyday business and pay a little, you know,
yeah,
50% tax or something.
So you want... humans just going to be pets?
Yeah.
You want some Independence Day where the spaceship's just threatening and doesn't do anything for a couple of days?
Yeah.
I could dig the intrigue. This is a very short movie. It's like 80 some minutes.
Yeah. Chad doesn't want the whole, debate. Are they good or bad? He just wants, these are bad aliens.
I'm just saying with the limited time they had, I get why they didn't, but I would be up for some intrigue of, okay, what are they going to do?
What are their terms? You know, right. Let's negotiate.
Yeah.
I mean, is it a lifetime supply of food and warm weather? I mean, what are we turning down here? I mean, maybe they have something that we want. I don't know.
Like gold.
Yeah.
But what do they want? You know?
I don't know. Maybe we're just going to be pets. Like very well taken care of pets.
Yeah. Let's not do that.
Best quote, Ben.
When an armed and threatening power lands uninvited in our capital, we don't meet him with tea and cookies.
Well, that was certainly the attitude of this movie. You're right.
That is some Team America, World Police, America, FBI type.
Yeah. That is good.
That's from my general.
I think Toby Keith could add that to a line in his song here. So
rest in peace, big dog.
So, Chad, best quote.
The quality of mercy is not strained. It droppeth as the gentle rain from heaven. So that is a Shakespeare quote from Carol, but she uses that to say something to the universal translator. And I think that's an excellent show, not only of her education and intelligence, but she's implying to the aliens, hey, how about mercy? How about a different way? That's clearly ignored, but I thought it was cool of her to do that. Just recall. Yeah.
My best quote's going to be, we operate in a very different time reference. You might say all of this is happening between ticks of your watch or the beats of your heart. Chad already mentioned it, but I really like that time play there. That opens up a lot of fun dynamics of this movie. So.
That's what kind of solidifies the sci-fi for me, not just the spacecraft, but they went that extra step of, okay, there's some theory crafting here going on. I want to explore this. What does that actually look like?
Yeah.
All right. Ben.
Yes, sir.
We've come full circle on a 5-star scale. Half-star intervals. Half-star being the worst. 5 being the best. What would you give Earth versus Flying Saucers from 1956?
I'd give it a 3.5 star.
3.5. Chad. How about you?
I'm right there with Ben again. I think this is an influential film. It's got great effects for the time. I think it's solid acting from the main stars, but the climax is sort of a dud for me. But it's something I can throw on and relax to. I just love these 50s invasion films. So give me more of this.
I'm a little touch behind you guys. I'm at 3 stars, but I still like it.
It's fair, yeah.
And a lot of it has to do with what it does. Like, I mean, if you had just showed this to me at a different time in my life, I might have said that this is corny. But then studying it, enjoying all that it has done, having seen other science fiction movies with the show, studying it, I can definitely see its place in history and really appreciate what it has done. So I do think it's influential, and I'm glad that you brought it to our table, Ben. You're not the first to shortlist it.
No.
So it is better than the title looks. I feel like the title is another thing that I considered for a change. One thing I feel like that is not a great title, just like Earth versus Flying Saucers. I thought, I don't know, Independence Day was a fun title or whatever. Like it's Invasion of the Body Snatchers kind of spells it out a little too much for you too. So I mean, on the nose. So I think I like The Day the Earth Stood Still, like something more poetic.
It does feel like it's missing an article. Like it should be Earth versus the flying saucers, right? Like we're missing that article.
I've gotten most of the way through the podcast without having done it too much, but I have a bad tendency to call it aliens versus flying saucers, which the aliens are in the flying saucers, and it's Earth, and it's not people versus aliens. It's really the Earth is a rock that we live on. The Earth's not really fighting back. I have a hard time with the Earth. You know, I mean, yeah,
Earthlings, maybe.
Yeah, sure. I don't know. Yeah. People, humans,
errant.
Yeah. All right.
Sentient.
Well, Chad, do you want to help me pick a movie from next time?
I would love to. So like the Rolling Stones say, I see a red door and I want it painted black. No colors anymore. I want them painted black. I am not singing that, but great song. We have three black and white classic film noir movies to discover. Which one will we watch next? So I'm going to serve up three options for you, Russell. Option number one is Naked City from 1948. A step-by-step look at a murder investigation on the streets of New York. Option two, New York Confidential from 1955. Top syndicate crime boss and his corrupt politicians make multi-million dollar deals and order murders until the vicious pattern finally catches up to him. Or option three, City Streets from 1931. Man joins a gang to free his girlfriend from prison. Very short IMDb on that one.
Let's get naked. Let's go to Naked City. Here we go.
Woo, naked time.
All right. Ben, thank you so much. You're always a joy to have on the show.
Thanks, guys. It was a pleasure.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Thank you, all the lords, ladies, and knights, the Retro Movie Roundtable. We invite you to reach out to us. We want to hear from you. Subscribe, rate, and review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, Pandora, wherever you get your podcasts. Subscribe on our YouTube channel. Give us a like on Facebook, on Instagram, and on Twitter at @movie_retro. Emails at retromovieroundtable@yahoo.com. And producing and providing this podcast is fun, but not free. So we invite you to support the show at our Patreon page at www.patreon.com/retromovieroundtable. All contributions are much appreciated and will go towards making the show better for you, the listeners. As always, thank you for listening. Be good to each other and watch more movies. Chat?
Stop and listen to me. They're here already. You're next.